always Richard Ramon. Take a deep, a brief break from our day-to-day commands. A deep and meaningful experience.
When we heed a certain call,
so for many
when the
reasons,
world
I'm
must come together
to
as one, there are people.
Hey, what's up now,
brother?
Hey, how you doing?
Party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig
like
it.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and kiss here today. Oh, pick it light. Take it back. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Right now.
Civil rights leader of the free world. Marvin Gaye was saying, war is not the answer. And tonight as we come to play the last Sunday the last sermon Dr. King preached before he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. And I want you to listen to that tape. I want you to analyze what Dr. King was saying. And Marvin Gaye was saying, war is not the answer. And Dr. King brought out all the negativities that the white man had put on black folks. And it's even on us today in our jobs, at work, in our schools, because of A. Philip Randolph and other civil rights leaders, we got where we at now. And I just want to share it with you tonight. This is honoring this whole month, Black History Month, talking about what happened. And our young folks need to know what happened with us. And once they know better, they can do better.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this.
Dr. King was talking about the war in Vietnam, where little brown children were bombed and killed at the Vietnam War. Right now, we're in the midst of a war over in the Middle East where people are being bombed and killed. Won't nobody say nothing. The free world ain't said nothing. It's what's going on. So what's going on today? Violence and murder is the order of the day. This is the last Sunday, Dr. King, the last sermon Dr. King spoke before his death. I want to play that.
The text for the morning is found in the book of Revelation. There are two passages there that I would like to quote. It's in the 16th chapter of that book. Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. I'm sure that most of you have read that arresting little story from the pen of Washington Irving entitled Rip Van Winkle. The one thing that we usually remember about the story is that Rip Van Winkle slept 20 years. But that is another point in that little story that is almost always completely overlooked. It was a sign in the end from which Rip went up in the mountain for his long sleep. when Rip Van Winkle went up in the mountain, the sign had a picture of King George III of England. When he came down, 20 years later, the sign had a picture of George Washington, the first president of the United States. And Rip Van Winkle looked up at the picture of George Washington, but in looking at the picture, he was amazed. He was completely lost. He knew not who he was. And this reveals to us that the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip slept 20 years, but that he slept through a revolution. While he was peacefully snoring up in the mountain, a revolution was taking place that at points would change the course of history. And Rip knew nothing about it. He was asleep. Yes, he slept through a revolution. One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitude, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution. There can be no gainsaying of the fact that the great revolution has taken place in the world today, in the sense it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. And that is the revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. And that is the human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that has taken place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place. That is still the voice crying through the vista of time, saying, the whole, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. Now, whenever anything new comes into history, it brings with it new challenges and new opportunities. And I would like to deal with the challenges that we face today as a result of this triple revolution that is taking place in the world today. First, we are challenged to develop a world perspective. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. Anyone who feels that he can live alone is sleeping through a revolution. The world in which we live is geographically one. The challenge that we face today is to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it's true that the geographical oneness of this age has come into being to a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in change. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. All of this tells us that our world is a neighborhood. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make up with a brotherhood. Somehow and in some way we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it's structured. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island in time itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We must see this, believe this, and live by it. If we are to remain awake through a great revolution. Secondly, we are challenged to eradicate the last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. I must say this morning that racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white America, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle, sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates, poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent than for America to work passionately and unrelenting to get rid of the disease of racism. Something positive must be done. Everyone must share in the guilt, as individuals and as institutions. The government must certainly share the guilt. Individuals must share the guilt. Even the church must share the guilt. We must face the sad fact. 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, when we stand to sing, in Christ there is no east nor west. We stand in the most segregated hour of America. The hour has come for everybody, for all institutions, the public sector and the private sector, to work to get rid of racism. Now, if we are to do it, we must honestly admit certain things and get rid of certain myths that have constantly been disseminated all over our nation. One is the myth of time. Here's the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. And there are those who often sincerely say to the Negro and his allies in the white community, why don't you slow up? Stop pushing things so fast. Only time can solve the problem. If you will just be nice and patient and continue to pray, in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out. That is an answer to that myth. It is a time. It's neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm sorry to say this morning that I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme righteous of our nation, the people on the wrong side, and use time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must have time and realize that the time is always right to do right. Now that is another myth that still gets around. It is a kind of over-reliance on the bootstrap philosophy. And there are those who still feel that if the Negro is to rise out of poverty, if the Negro is to rise out of slum conditions, if he is to rise out of discrimination and segregation, he must do it all by himself. And so they say the Negro must lift himself by his own bootstraps. They never stop to realize that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. Those famous never stop to realize that the nation made the black man's color a stigma. But beyond this, they never stop to realize the debt that they owe people who were kept in slavery 244 years. In 1863, the Negro was told that he was free as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation being signed by Abraham Lincoln. But he was not given any land to make that freedom meaningful. It was something like keeping a person in prison for a number of years and suddenly discovering that that person is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted. Just go up to him and say, now you're free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to get some clothes to put on his back or to get on his feet again in life. Every code of jurisprudence would rise up against this. And yet this is the very thing that our nation did to the black man. It simply said, you're free. And it left him there penniless, illiterate, not knowing what to do. And the irony of it all is that at the same time, the nation failed to do anything for the black man. Through an act of Congress, it was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, it built land grant colleges to teach them how to farm. Not only that, it provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, the years unfolded, it provided low interest rates so that they could mechanize our farms. And to this day, thousands of these fair persons are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies every year not to farm. And these are so often the very people who tell Negroes that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps. It's all right to tell a man to lift himself by his own bootstraps, but it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. has come to see that the roots of racism are very deep in our country. And there must be something positive and massive in order to get rid of all of the effects of racism and the tragedies of racial injustice. Now that is another thing closely related the racism that I would like to mention as another challenge. We are challenged to rid our nation and the world of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, poverty spreads its nagging, prehensile tentacles into hamlets and villages all over our world. 2/3 of the people of the world go to bed hungry at night. They are ill-housed, they are ill-nourished, they are shabbily clad. I've seen it in Latin America, I've seen it in Africa. I've seen this poverty in Asia. I remember some years ago, Mrs. King and I journeyed to that great country known as India. And I never will forget the experience. It was a marvelous experience to meet, talk with the great leaders of India, to meet and talk with and speak to thousands and thousands of people all over that vast country. These experiences will remain dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall linger. But I say to you this morning, my friends, there were those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes God's children sleeping on the sidewalks at night? In Bombay, more than 1 million people sleep on the sidewalks every night. In Calcutta, more than 600,000 sleep on the sidewalks every night. They have no beds to sleep in. They have no houses to go in. How can one avoid being depressed? He discovers that out of India's population, more than 500 million people, some 480 million make an annual income of less than $90 a year. Most of them have never seen a doctor or a dentist. As I noticed these things, something within me cried out, can we in America stand idle by and not be concerned? And an answer came, oh no, because the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation. And I started thinking of the fact that we spend in America millions of dollars a day to store surplus food. And I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children all over the world who go to bed hungry at night. Maybe we spend far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. Not only do we see poverty abroad, I would remind you that in our own nation, there are about 40 million people who are poverty-stricken. I have seen them here and there. I've seen them in the ghettos of the north. I've seen them in the rural areas of the south. I've seen them in Appalachia. I've just been in the process of touring many areas of our country. And I must confess that in some situations, I literally found myself crying. I was was in Marks, Mississippi the other day, which is in Quitman County, first county in the United States. I tell you, I saw hundreds of little black boys and black girls walking the streets with no shoes to wear. I saw their mothers and their fathers trying to carry on a little Head Start program, but they had no money. Federal government hadn't funded them. They were trying to carry on, and they raised a little money here and there, trying to get a little food to feed the children, trying to teach them a little something. I saw mothers and fathers who said to me, not only were they unemployed, but they didn't get any kind of income, no old age pension, no welfare check for anything. I said, how do you live? They said, well, we go around to the neighbors and ask them for a little something. When the berry season comes, we pick berries. When the rabbit season comes, we hunt and catch a few rabbits. And that's about it. I was in Newark in Holland just this week. And I walked in to the homes of welfare mothers. I saw them in conditions, no, not with wall-to-wall carpet, wall-to-wall rats and roaches. I stood in an apartment. This welfare mother said to me, the landlord will not repair this place. I've been here 2 years. He hadn't made a single repair. She pointed out a little boy who was the victim of lead poisoning. She pointed out the walls with all of the ceiling falling through. She showed me the hole where the rats came in. She said, night after night, we have to stay awake. Keep the rats and the roaches from getting to the children. I said, how much do you pay for this apartment? She said, $125. I looked and I thought and said to myself, it isn't worth $60. Poor people are forced to pay more for less. Living in conditions day in and day out where the whole area is constantly drained without being replenished, it becomes a kind of domestic colony. And the tragedy is so awful. These 40 million people are invisible because America is so affluent, so rich. Because our expressways carry us away from the ghetto, we don't see the poor. Jesus told a parable one day, and he reminded us that a man went to hell because he didn't see the poor. His name was Diabetes. He was a rich man. And there was a man by the name of Lazarus, who was a poor man, but not only was he poor, he was sick. Sores were all over his body. He was so weak that he could hardly move. He managed to get to the gate of Diabetes every day, wanting just to have the crumb that would fall from his table. Diabetes did nothing about it. Parable ends saying, Diabetes went to hell, and there was a thick gulf now between Lazarus and Diabetes. Now, that is nothing in that parable which says that Diabetes went to hell because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against all wealth. It is true that one day a rich young ruler came to him, and he advised him to sell all. But in that instance, Jesus was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. And if you will look at that parable with all of its symbolism, you will remember that a conversation took place between heaven and hell, and on the other end of that long distance call between heaven and hell was Abraham in heaven, talking to Diabetes in hell. Now, Abraham was a very rich man. If you go back to the Old Testament, you see that he was the richest man of his day. So it was not a rich man in hell talking with a poor man in heaven. It was a little millionaire in hell talking with a multimillionaire in heaven. Diabetes didn't go to hell because he was rich. Diabetes didn't realize that his wealth was his opportunity. It was his opportunity to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother Lazarus. Diabetes went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and he never really saw him. He went to hell because he allowed his brother to become invisible. Diabetes went to hell because he maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. And Diabetes went to hell because he sought to be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty. This can happen to America, the richest nation in the world. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. The question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. But the real question is whether we have the will. In a few weeks, some of us are coming to Washington to see if the will is still alive or if it is alive in this nation. We're coming to Washington in a poor people's campaign. Yes, we're going to bring the tired, the poor, the huddled masses. We're going to bring those who have known long years of certain neglect. We're going to bring those who come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. We're going to bring children and adults and old people, people who've never seen a doctor or a dentist in their lives. We're not coming to engage in any histrionic gesture. We're not coming to tap Washington. We are coming to demand that the government will address itself to the problem of poverty. We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty, the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He really exists. We are coming to ask America to be true to the huge promise Burinoke that it signed years ago. We are coming to engage in dramatic, nonviolent action to call attention to the gulf between promise and fulfillment, to make the invisible visible. Why do we do it this way? We do it this way because it is our experience that the nation doesn't move around questions of genuine equality for the poor and for black people until it is confronted massively, dramatically, in terms of direct action. Great documents are here to tell us something should be done. We met here some years ago in the White House conference on civil rights. And we out with the same recommendations that we will be demanding in our campaign here, but nothing has been done. Environmental and not racial. Poverty, ignorance, social. We seek to combine the truths of two opposites while avoiding the extremes of both. So the realists would agree with the optimists that we have come a long, long way, but he would seek to balance that by agreeing with the pessimists that we have a long, long way to go. And it is this realistic position that I would like to take as the basis for our thinking together this evening as we deal with the question of progress in race relations and as we deal with the whole question of the future of integration. We have come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go before the problem is solved. Now let us notice first that we have made meaningful strides. And I think I should point out that the Negro himself has come a long, long way in reevaluating his own intrinsic worth. In order to illustrate this, a little history is necessary. You will remember that it was in the year 1619 when the first Negro slaves landed on the shores of this nation. They were brought here from the soils of Africa. Unlike the Pilgrim Fathers who landed at Plymouth a year later, they were brought here against their will. Throughout slavery, the Negro was treated in a very inhuman fashion. He was a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. The famous Dred Scott decision of 1857 well illustrated the status of the Negro during slavery. For in this decision, the Supreme Court of our nation said in substance, that the Negro is not a citizen of the United States, he is merely property, subject to the dictates of his owner. And it went on to say that the Negro has no rights, that the white man is bound to respect. With the growth of slavery, it became necessary to give some justification for it. It seems to be a fact of life that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually reaching out for some thin rationalization to clothe an obvious truth, a wrong rather, in the beautiful garments of righteousness. And this is exactly what happened. Even religion and the Bible were misused in order to crystallize the patterns of the status quo and justify the whole system of slavery. And so it was argued by some that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. The Apostle Paul's dictum became a watchword, servants, be obedient to your master. And then one brother had probably read the logic of the great philosopher Aristotle. You will remember that Aristotle did a great deal to bring into being what we now know as formal logic in philosophy. Formal logic has a big word known as the syllogism, and the syllogism has a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so this brother decided to put his argument of the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He came out with his major premise, all men are made in the image of God. Then came his minor premise, God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro, therefore the Negro is not a man. This is the kind of reasoning that prevailed. Well, living with the system of slavery and then later segregation, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. Many came to feel that perhaps they were less than human. But then something happened to the Negro. The circumstances made it possible and necessary for him to travel more. The coming of the automobile, the upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression. So his rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. Even his economic life was gradually rising through the growth of industry, the influence of organized labor, expanded educational opportunities.
Even his cultural life was gradually rising through the steady decline of crippling illiteracy. All of these forces conjoined to cause the Negro to take a new look at himself. Negro masses all over began to reevaluate themselves. The Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children, and that all men are made in his image, and that the basic thing about a man is not his specificity, but his fundamentum, not the texture of his hair or the color of his skin, but his eternal dignity and worth. And so the Negro could now unconsciously cry out with the eloquent poet, "Fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole, or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to struggle, to suffer, and to sacrifice in order to be free. And so in a real sense, we've come a long, long way since 1619. But not only has the Negro himself come a long, long way in re-evaluating his own intrinsic worth, we are to be true to the facts. We must say that the whole nation has come a long, long way in extending the frontiers of civil rights. Now, there are so many things we could point to. As one who has lived in the South all of my life, I can certainly point to this because it's so easy to see the change. 30 years ago, even 25 years ago, a year hardly passed, when numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched in the South by some vicious mob. But lynchings have about ceased today. At the turn of the century, there were very few Negroes registered to vote in the South. By 1948, that number had leaped to about 750,000. By 1960, it had leaped to 1,300,000. By 1964, it leaped to 2,196,000. When the Supreme Court of our nation rendered a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which established the doctrine of separate but equal as the law of the land. Of course, we all know what happened as a result of the Plessy doctrine. There was always a strict enforcement of the separate without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. The Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. Then in 1954, the Supreme Court of our nation examined the legal body of segregation and on May 17th of that year pronounced it constitutionally dead. It said in substance that the old Plessy doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. And so since that decision, we have seen many significant developments. Along with that, we've seen other legislative developments which have brought us nearer to the goal of justice. In 1964, President Johnson signed a comprehensive civil rights bill which had been so ably recommended by the late President Kennedy. And then in 1965, President Johnson signed the new voting rights bill, which is now the law of the land. All of these things are significant. And so in a real sense, to put it figuratively in biblical language, we've broken loose from the Egypt of slavery. And we have moved through the wilderness of separate but equal. And now we stand on the border of the promised land of integration. And we have come a long, long way since 1896. Now this would be a wonderful place for me to bring an end to my talk tonight. First, it would mean making a short speech, and that would be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. Again, it would mean that the problem is just about solved in America and that we really have nothing to be concerned about. We don't have much work to do. And it would be a marvelous thing if every speaker was able to talk about this problem in terms of a problem that once existed but that no longer has existence. But I'm afraid if I stop now, I will not be telling the total truth. I would be stating a fact, certainly, but not the whole truth. You see, a fact is merely the absence of contradiction, but truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of facts. Now, it is a fact that we've come a long, long way, but in order to get the whole truth, we've got to bring the other side into being. And if I stop at this point, I will leave you the victims of a dangerous optimism. If I stop here, I will allow us to end up with an illusion wrapped in superficiality. So in order to tell the truth, it is necessary to move on and say not only have we come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go all over America before the dream of brotherhood, before the ideal of integration is a reality. Now, we need not look very far to make this point. We need only open our eyes, read our newspapers, look at our televisions, and look around in our communities. And we know that we are not yet at the point where we can boast of clean hands in the area of brotherhood. I mentioned the fact that lynchings have about ceased. But other things are happening just as tragic. I can remind you of the fact tonight that over the last 18 months, more than 13 or 14 Negro and white civil rights workers have been brutally murdered all across the South. And if one would look at the jury system, look at the courts, you would soon discover that in most cases nobody has even been convicted for all of these murders. This reveals that we have a long, long way to go. I mentioned the fact that we made strides in voter registration. We have a new voting rights bill, and this is marvelous. But there are still areas where Negroes who seek to register and vote confront economic reprisals. And I submit to you tonight that in places like Lowndes County in Alabama and numerous counties in Mississippi, people have been put off, thrown off the land and put out of their little humble dwelling places simply because they went down on the basis of the new. Voting rights bill and sought to register and become citizens by being registered voters. This tells us that we have a long, long way to go. I mentioned the economic area and that figure $30 billion sounded big. We must see the other side, and that is the painful, tragic side. And that is the fact that 42% of the Negro families of our country still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 16% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. Some 20% of the Negro families of our country earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. 88% of the Negro families of our country earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. And so the Negro finds himself perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. And the problem is becoming even more difficult today. For years we have been victimized with discrimination in many areas and on many levels. Denied apprenticeship training, deprived of educational opportunities, facing discrimination in so many areas. And this meant that so often we were limited to unskilled and semi-skilled labor. And now, because automation and cybernation have come into being, these are the jobs that are passing away. And so while the nation stands in its most prosperous period, while the nation faces its lowest level of unemployment that it has over the last seven or eight years, unemployment among Negroes is at its highest level. While the average for the nation is still around 4%, and we turn to the Negro community, the unemployment rate at times goes as high as 14%. Which means that is a major depression within the Negro community economically. And we can see the problems that this will bring about. And people are deprived of economic security. They're deprived of opportunity to educate their children. They're deprived of opportunity of getting proper medical care. They are deprived of the opportunity of being able to live in decent housing situations. They are deprived of the opportunity of having the basic necessities of life. And finally, they are deprived of the opportunity of respecting themselves. And so often, out of self-hatred, and out of embarrassment, and out of humiliation, they lose motivation. And it is not enough to look at the effects of discrimination. It is necessary for a concerned and compassionate nation to look at the causal basis of the whole problem. For instance, there are those who can argue ad infinitum about the fact that the Negro is culturally behind. And so they say we must not integrate certain areas of life, whether it's in housing or schools or what have you, because the Negro is so far behind that he will pull the white race a generation behind. And they go on to say, you know, the Negro is a criminal. He has the highest crime rate in any community. And the arguments go on and on and on and on. Well, if there are lagging standards in the Negro community, and there certainly are, they lag because of segregation and discrimination. Criminal responses are environmental and not racial. Ignorance, social isolation, economic deprivation, breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. It is necessary for the great and a concerned nation to go back to the causal basis for the problem. And we have a long, long way to go in order to make justice a reality all over this country. It means that there must be massive programs, training programs, and
open eyes that we may see to follow
matter.